This is the Better Architecture Podcast, and you're listening to Season 2, Design Media India 2024 edition of The Talks.
Hello everyone, I am Shubhayan, your host, and a warm welcome to the very first episode of Season 2 of the Better Architecture Podcast, that is Design Media India 2024 edition, wherein I'm talking to diverse industry professionals to try and document the various avenues of the architecture and design media industry in the country. Now, I already have done a pilot episode about what this season will bring and what it aims to be and all that and blah blah. So I'm not gonna repeat. And with that, let's jump right in. Today, my guest is architect Rohan Shivkumar. Rohan is based out of Mumbai. He is a filmmaker as well as an educator. If you follow him on social media, you will know that he is crazy about movies and, you know, keeps posting on clips and small analysis all the time. Welcome to the show, Rohan. I hope you and your family are doing good in these times.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Things are fine. Everyone's fine in Bombay right now, at least for now.
That's really assuring to hear, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed for the best to happen to all of us. Now, before moving forward, I'd request my audience to head out to the description to check out Rohan's complete bio. You know, that just helps you to take the maximum out of this conversation. Now, so coming to the topic, design media. I mean, that's the name of the season, I understand, but when we talk of media in architecture and design, what comes to your mind? How do you look at this particular subdomain of this field? People call it architectural journalism, some call it architecture journalism, some use design journalism, but in my limited understanding, it's much more than journalism that we are doing here. So I just prefer to use the term design media, kind of because the word media provides a larger understanding of the entire domain in itself. So from that perspective, from that perception, what's your idea of how media works in architecture, or say design as an umbrella term?
I think for any profession, actually any discipline at all, to have a place where it is able to discuss ideas that are not completely production based, but rather a space where conversations can happen concerning the reasons why we do things, the modes in which we do things, a place that can offer a mirror within which we can see ourselves. And when we see ourselves in that mirror, we are able to adjust who we want to be and who we want to become. I think it's an extremely important space for any discipline to have if it has to really grow and if it has to really attain new heights or take on new challenges. I have a feeling that, unfortunately, in India, that has not necessarily happened over many years. Although I believe that in the early 20s and 30s, there were magazines that really were platforms for really talking about what the larger concerns of architecture can be, what the larger concerns of design can be, and really then thinking about what role architecture should take, what are the sorts of references it should have. I think there were spaces like that once. But I have a feeling that may just be my own kind of perception of the time when I was not around. But ever since, actually, I've been aware of the architectural profession, I found that most architectural magazines, especially, and I'm only talking about magazines first and talk about the others a little later. Okay. Most architectural magazines tend to be a little overly romantic about the architecture profession, a little too sentimental often, and unfortunately, a little too laudatory and not really critical. I also think that that leads to a certain culture of self-congratulate, kind of, let's say, complacency. And that itself can be a very problematic space. If the mirror that you have in front of you is always telling you that you are fine and you're good and you're great, then you don't see any reason to transfer. You're never able to place yourselves in any other context to say that, okay, maybe those are new challenges I need to take. The mirror's role as a media is really to be able to show the truth of who you are and challenge you to do better. And I do think that that is something that I would have liked to see more of in many more architecture journals, at least for certain. The other spaces where we've had this sort of places that can work as mirrors, of course, are conferences, where you have these big sort of conferences and awards very often that are sponsored by some companies and things like that. I mean, they're good to have. But even though we're there, what we find is that the kinds of work that are being showcased and the modes through which even the awards are given tend to kind of really focus on only some kinds of practices. And again, very often, because the architecture profession is so incestuous, everybody knows everybody, that nobody's really willing to challenge critically. So I think that that is really a problematic thing that I find, that it's, you know, that the spaces that we have in India for the creation of dialogue are too often too complacent. That's my own feeling. The third space, of course, is that of social media, which I find is an interesting place because the social media space comes in, of course, many different modes. You have architects who are very often showcasing their work within their Instagram accounts, and they're supposed to appreciate the work that they do, and some of the work is quite incredible. But that itself comes with its own problematic because the work itself is then kind of produced for that image itself. And it's the image itself that then gets consumed as fact. So I find that that itself comes with its own sorts of dangers and problems. But of course, the social media space can also become a space of great amount of activism, like we found with the Central Vista project, where an entire group of people came together to try and make some sort of collective voice against that particular project. And you have a third mode, which is actually quite an interesting mode. You know, many of the young students, they seem to take upon social media as a space to vent about everything that is wrong with the architectural profession. And they kind of go crazy with that stuff, which I think is, and in some senses, it's indicative of the fact that in the mainstream critical kind of media, there is no space for critical thinking. So it then comes out in these sorts of eruptions of almost violent kind of behavior. Does that answer vaguely?
Okay. And yes, this does answer my ask. Very first question of the very first episode, and I come across a beautiful thought. That is media as a mirror, as a true reflection of what architecture or design aims to be in real. It's reflection in print. Well, or online, or any other form of communication. And in that, I think you have clarified your stance that, yeah, it becomes self-congratulatory. And that there isn't much option of being critical. So thank you for addressing the elephant in the room right at the start, but we are gonna touch on these critical aspects a little later in the episode. You know, the absence of criticality in design media, as you have said. Let's save that up for later and directly move on to what you have been involved with. Cinema, or say the visual format of storytelling, is where you're at. So, what was the guiding force behind you choosing to take up cinema as your method of putting yourself out to the world? I mean, why this form of expression?
It's a good question, and I don't think I have a very easy answer for it. When I finished my architecture course in 95, and I went for a master's, came back in 97, I think I was always interested in the world of ideas. And I love architecture because architecture really affects the way that people live in the world. So it's very deeply related with the human condition. So for me, the architecture is, I mean, I've always loved architecture that is pretty much about people. And I don't get too taken up, although I do find them incredible. These buildings that are extraordinarily beautifully made or, you know, fantastically put together. In other words, my interest is towards space and not necessarily towards building per se. I'm more interested in the kinds of spaces that are. Because in each of those spaces, narratives and stories are about people and their lives. And architecture becomes a stage set, a catalyst, as it were, for these encounters between people to happen, between encounters between people and nature to happen, encounters between people and the transcendent to happen. So that's what I've always loved about architecture. And for me, teaching became a way of really talking about that, being able to communicate those ideas, to be able to really kind of tell the world how I like to see architecture. I even had a blog in the middle, and I really felt the need to kind of communicate and things. So I think teaching was really amazing for me personally as a medium that allowed me to grow quite a bit. I always thought of teaching as something that I was growing through. And then I started writing, and on the blog, I started making notes. It just became a way of documenting everything that I'm seeing in the world and really whatever I was thinking about it. And some of that early writing is embarrassingly sort of amateurish, but you know, it's still there. I mean, I'm not particularly embarrassed by those, but I do recognize that they are not particularly brilliant pieces of writing either, but they were fun for me to have. Then in around 2009, I got involved with a project that was called Cinema City, Project Cinema City, it was called. It was a multidisciplinary sort of a project where we were working across many disciplines, including filmmakers and artists and historians, trying to understand the relationship between cinema and the city of Bonn. That was what the project was about. It was a massive project. We did a lot of research work. And in that project, I suddenly became more aware, as well as I started having many friends within the, I wouldn't call it the film industry because that implies Bollywood, but really people who are working within the film medium. And one thing that struck me about that medium is that it has an incredible ability to create complex arguments, that it can be used didactically, that it can be used to kind of, you know, give messages, okay? But it can, more importantly, at least for me, it can be used as a medium through which the relationship between the observer and the producer can in many ways be more intimate, perhaps, because of the act of image making. The abilities that images have to be able to communicate a certain kind of tangibility. So I think that's what really interested me within film. I also realized that as a medium, it has a certain kind of, there is a way in which it can be consumed now that is easier in some ways to many people because we live so much on screens. So I think those were the sorts of ideas that I got excited by when we were looking at film. And of course, I have my closest friend is a filmmaker. So he was also excited by that. So we decided to work on films together. And since he is trained as a filmmaker, I didn't have to worry about the technical aspects because I do believe that it's important for anyone working in the media to have training in it, because otherwise it ends up becoming fairly amateurish. And I think form is important. And so it's important to have people who understand the form, understand the craft of making films. So Mukul worked in that medium. So I was very lucky to have him work with me on these projects. So that's actually how my interest in the film medium came up. And as I was working within the film medium, I realized many more things about it. While you're making it, you realize that what are the various things you can do with it. And the kinds of films that we made were then ways of trying to work within the media and challenge that media as well. So it wasn't only that medium is, you know, the word medium I find to be a kind of interesting one. You know, even I have to kind of think about Marshall McLuhan's famous statement where he says the medium is the message. And I have to really then think about, okay, that there is no separation in many ways between what the message is and what the medium is. So the medium and the form of the medium itself needs to be manipulated and played with such that the message becomes complex and dense and interesting. So the film medium then became a medium that I also wanted to play with in terms of form, not so much only as the medium to convey information.
That's interesting. So act of image making is one key point that I'm taking out from this. Another important takeaway that I will point out for my audience is when you said that it's important to have some kind of training in media or else the work becomes fairly amateurish. Next takeaway is that media is the message on which you have elaborated as to how you're using movies as a tool to give out the message. So that's cool. And now in continuation, the next thing that I want to ask you is about how filmmaking pans out as a choice of livelihood, especially for the young ones in the industry or for those who are trying to make a shift. How would you say that making films, creating documentaries comes back on the pockets? I mean, you know, the financials of it, if you can give some clarity on the same.
So it really depends on the kind of filmmaker you want to be. Unfortunately, especially since the new government has come in, a lot of sources of funding for documentary have dried. So even if there are state-sponsored funds available, those funds are largely catering towards a sort of propagandist imagination of what documentary film is supposed to be doing. Or you get foreign funding to make a film, but even that is difficult nowadays. And foreign funding comes with its own baggage that they want to see India or see certain subjects in certain. So it's going to be restricted. But if you want to work in film, obviously a lot of filmmakers are making a lot of money. And many of my students have actually gone ahead and become filmmakers. So, but they're not necessarily working within documentary. They're working within mainstream Hindi films, perhaps. And they're doing very well. Some of them are directors. Some of them are actors. Some of them are set designers. So they're doing well. And I'm very happy that they're doing very well. But if you are imagining that making documentary films only can sustain your family right now, it's got to be a difficult thing to do, is my frank opinion. That's not to say that you can't do it. Like, I am making films right now, but I have also a full-time job. And yes, we do have very, very generous producers who are interested in the films that we are making. So we are lucky. But I wouldn't like to presume that everybody is going to be that lucky. Perhaps they can be luckier. But you know, it is a difficult thing. Everyone's trajectories are different. Everyone's kinds of histories are different. So automatically, everyone's horizons then are dependent on their own sorts of abilities as well as their histories. So it's a little difficult to make a generalization that way. I would say that, but mentally and emotionally, and just in terms of excitement of seeing the world through a new medium, of being able to understand what the potentials of those mediums are, it's been a very, at least for me, it's been an amazing thing. I mean, I spent my past 10 years at least, you know, thinking about films and doing things. I've really enjoyed it. I think I've grown a lot because of it. For me, architecture is everywhere and everything. You know, so as somebody who's trained as an architect and has taught architecture very long, my lens is always going to be architectural aspiration. Even when I'm watching Sanjay Leela Bhansali's Savariya, I'm looking at it through an architectural or spatial lens. So that is always going to be part of my history and my identity and the way that I see the world. So even now when Mukul and I are making, currently we are interested in making a film on sacred landscapes as that. My lens is spatial. The way that I'm interested in, spaceship. And when I'm saying spatial, it involves performance, it involves ritual, it involves history, it involves culture, all of the above. But everything has to happen in space. And so my interest is always going to be in many ways shaped by my own predilections towards architecture. So I don't know what the future is going to be. Right now, we are working on a film, our fourth film together, officially at least. And that film does have an architectural, or rather a spatial kind of root base, as far as I'm concerned. So I always bring into the mix, and Mukul brings his interest in representation, in image making into the mix. And so I think that's how we work with each other.
Right. I think my audience got a fair point about the sustainability or the economics of this entire scenario. And understandably, this is something that I also know, that independent filmmaking or documentary making as an industry in India is not yet so lucrative that you can, you know, just do that and have a doable cash flow as such. But yeah, what you said, it's always good to have a steady job at hand before venturing out. Also, what's interesting is that you have been telling about your friend in film with whom you work. So another key takeaway for my audience is the utmost importance of collaboration. So moving on, let's discuss the eternal doubt about whether working in films or any kind of visual media requires high-end gadgets. Because many a times we see people telling that, okay, I don't have the best camera, I don't have the best gadgets, so I can't produce the best of results, you know. What is your particular opinion on this specific aspect? So how are you looking at this debate?
This is always a difficult one in some way, is that I don't think necessarily that the greatest gadgets give you the most fantastic results. I've seen entire films that have been shot on iPhones and cell phones that just are incredible too. I think it's important to treat the medium with respect for what it can do and for what it allows you to, because there are incredible things that have happened with, you know, we just think about architecture, right? There's so much incredible architecture that has been built with the most basic materials and financial resources. Well, some of the most incredibly high-tech financial resources have led to some extraordinarily awful architecture too. So I don't think it has so much to do with the, what are called the high level, low level. I mean, those are all myths. No? I think the medium has a certain kind of ability, whether that's paper or whether that's film. And if one is able to kind of work with that medium respectfully and playfully and energetically, I think one can create incredible things. I don't think that the medium necessarily is the problem. The problem is the other. The problem is craftsmanship. And that doesn't mean finish. I mean, there's always this problem that people very often equate craftsmanship with ekdam chakachak finish. That's not what I mean. Craftsmanship is the ability to understand the potentials of the material and understand what it is capable of, and what are the sorts of incredible experiences one can have with it. And those can be tacky, those can be brutal, those can be sublime. So I don't think a fabulous image and a perfect sound is necessarily the basis for great film. I mean, I've seen many great Hollywood films with beautiful sound design and beautiful everything that are just the worst films ever. That's why I'm saying I don't think it's the medium so much. I think it's the way in which one works with the medium. I would also suggest one more thing to anyone who is wanting to start out in something is I genuinely believe in history and the knowledge of the space. So if you are interested in film, watch films, lots of them, and do it with dedication. Do it with sincerity. Watch carefully, write about it, do whatever you want to, but always remember that one can learn from people who have done it before. So the more you open yourself out to the world, the more you learn. I'm not one who believes that one can be original in a void. I genuinely believe that one needs to have references, one needs to acknowledge references, one needs to work within the world of images and ideas for one to be able to grow. If that is what you're interested in, then you need to know what the potentials and the possibilities are from entire world of images that is there before you right now. And it's so easy to do right now. It's a click, a button, and it's at your fingertips. And I think that's amazing, those possibilities that are there.
Okay, I think that was a really inspiring message for my audience. And I think you have also clarified that the best of the works exist on the cheapest side of the spectrum and the worst of productions do exist on the costliest end of the line. Right, so yeah, persistence, observation and a will to do is the message here. Another point that I should drive home is when you say that quality doesn't always have to do with finish. What you said, na? Ekdam chaka chak finish. So that's that. Right, now moving towards the last leg of the discussion, and I'm gonna ask this to all of my guests here and collect raw, unfiltered responses for the same. Say, for the future of the media avenues in architecture and design. Now, India produces close to around 24,000 BR graduates per year. The number might vary a little bit here and there, but then that number is increasing annually. And we have a good number of people in the media domain now, definitely with more adding per year. And again, we know that people doing the same kind of jobs tend to come together and associate, like let's say IIA, ISOLA, ADI, ITPI. I mean, we have so many more. But if you look at it like that, there exists no specific body for the design media professionals till now. So that's my question. Say, how do you feel about an institution that looks exclusively at architectural media? So is there a need? Should we be working towards something like this? And what should be the agendas of such a body, you know, positives, negatives, etc.?
I think the idea of having an institutional framework has its advantages, of course, because you now have the ability to create new platforms for doing things. That's what it is possible. And I think that is a good initiative to have. The danger, of course, is the danger that happens with most institutions is that institutions end up becoming power centers, power structures come into play. Who's in charge, who's not in charge, what is allowed, what is not allowed, you know, or who can be part of it, who's not part of it. Is this architecture? Is that media? You have this entire thing that can begin and that can very often lead to an institution that was meant to create a platform for support end up becoming more that is one of the things that one needs to kind of possibly watch out for. But of course, I think it's an important thing if we are able to understand what the role of this institution is meant to be. Why does this institution need to exist at all? Why is the question, right? Let's think about that a little bit. The issue is, let's say, education, because a lot of people who end up writing for these journals and are usually young graduates who come out who don't really understand much about the history of writing or anything, actually. They're just people who've come out of school and managed to put the full stop in the right place and they get a job because they have the basic English skills. Because those skills are there. So that's one issue, is that forget the fact that they can write English, because that is only one language. How do we get people who have analytical skills and understanding of history and theory to be able to be sharp and critical about what is being spoken of? That is the first thing. But there's so many people who are coming out every year from master's courses around the country and around the world who seem like they do. The second thing is, of course, the English issue, which is a big thing. All of our conversations, everything that we talk about, most architecture schools tend to be focusing on the English language as the medium through which ideas are communicated. And of course, it is an extremely powerful language. And more we find that because of this entire sort of emphasis on English, people who are not necessarily very comfortable with the language, okay, but they may really have incredible architectural skills. And that might actually be one of the main issues with the architectural journalism right now, is that they don't have access to all the different languages of architecture that are happening in the country, primarily also maybe because they cannot speak those languages. So I have a feeling that that's the other kind of thing I would like to kind of say, is that I think one needs to really start expanding the mediums or the languages through which one not only reads what the world is. And when I'm saying language here, I mean this in two ways. One is architectural languages itself. What called good architecture continues to be based on the modernist imagination of what is called good. So there are some fancy facade, composed windows, and maybe once in a while some real brickwork for us to get really excited about. And that is what we call good architecture in all magazines, right? Unwaveringly in India. Now, the question is that, does that really enable us to ask, okay, wait, this is called good architecture, but is it good architecture? Rather also, why is it called good architecture? Why is something else not called good architecture? Who is the one that made that judgment? And I think if you kind of dig deeper within this, you'll realize that there's very clearly a class bias in what is being called good architecture. Because if you see most of the buildings that are being built, that are being called good architecture, they belong and are being designed by a very particular class of architects. With social capital, with money, with connections, that's the world, right? And that class of people is busy trying to perform modernity, busy trying to perform progressiveness, and therefore they publish certain kinds of work, and the architectural media, of course, loves that kind of work because it looks good in photographs and can be published on art media. So therefore, you have this entire cycle that is actually a very closed circle of what is called good architecture, who's making it and who's writing about it. And English itself comes with that entire package. Because that is, of course, international. Now, if one has to really think about, if you have to look at the media as a mirror, and one looks in the mirror right now, at the architectural profession and looks at the number of buildings on the number of these, just looks at the number of people those particular buildings really affect, those farmhouses in Alibag or outside Ahmedabad. That's minuscule, tiny. But we have reams and reams of articles written about the wonderful brickwork and the light and shadow and the wondrous chandeliers and whatever they have in there. So if one has to recalibrate that entire thing, then it requires us to really think very closely about, is that what really architecture is meant to do? But if you read anywhere what architects claim that they want to do, they'll say the usual: social, political, economic, ecological. In reality, if you look at this, none of those buildings have any of the above. They're not really concerned about. So are we willing to look at ourselves in the mirror, the media, in a much more harder, critical way? And if we do, running the danger of being rejected wholesale by the same class that currently controls the architectural fraternity. The problem is really there now, because architectural media lives on the validation that comes from architects rather than the other way around. What should actually be happening is that architectural media should be the critical voice that says that, listen, guys, you guys are screwing up. Do we have the strength to be able to build that? Now, if your institution is able to create such a platform, then it may have some sort of real validity. Okay. If it's going to continue being subservient to the great architects, that entire bunch of people who all meet at the same conferences and make the same presentations to each other and say the most wonderful things face to face, then hey, it's just another sort of self-congratulatory world. It's okay. It can exist. There's no problem with it. But if you ask me whether it's going to be really effective, I'm like, theek hai, kya effect hoga? Same thing.
Wow. I mean, shit. Like, I will be very honest here. First episode, first guest of season 2 of the talks. And we are already on the track where real stuff is being spoken. Things that needs to be said is being said. And definitely, yeah, I can't tell you how happy I am right now. But then understanding what you just said, if such an institution comes up in the near future, then there is a 100% possibility that this section of the fraternity, you know, the one which is involved in sugarcoating and glorifying architecture and all the class bias that you just mentioned, that they will too be a part of this. And honestly speaking, I will say that they need to be a part of this. So the next doubt is, the next question is that how do we find a middle ground, a compromise between commercial architectural media and critical architectural media? So how do these coexist?
Why is it assumed that critical architectural media is not commercial?
Interesting. Say history, because if media tends to be critical, then the acceptability of the same tends to get lower. And when the acceptability gets lower, then the commercialization of the same becomes a big trouble.
Outrage. Architecture Review. Let's look at the 1960s in Britain, when Rainer Banham was being critical about so many things within mainstream architectural media, where there were fights happening in print, okay, between different points of view about brutalism and about modernism. These are things that were happening pretty much in the public realm and the mainstream media. But gender, caste and class is so deeply embedded in our structure that we are so extraordinarily feudal, okay, as a society. And that society structure is replicated in the power structures of architecture. That we presume, therefore, that club, that's me, let me put it very simply, I'm not saying I'm outside that club. I very much am part of that club. Okay, because I do get to conferences and I do teach. I mean, I cannot absolve myself of that responsibility. Okay, I am part of that bloody group. But I recognize the problem that is there. I find that we kind of very often silence ourselves from saying things that we really want to, because we are afraid of what our friends might say. Okay, and we are also afraid of what our friends might say, because then we may not get invited to the next, to write about the next building that somebody has made. So that is where we are. We are that kind of society. Okay. Now, for us to be able to kind of really think about what the role of media is in that kind of society, it's difficult. I mean, look at what has happened to Republic TV and all the mainstream media. They are just basically, whatever power says, they will go in that direction. They are lapdogs. They have no position. That's what has happened to even the mainstream media in India. They do not have any sort of strength, although at least they have an organization that's the Press Trust of India to kind of say that you all have separate rights. But in our rather feudal architectural community, where everyone knows everyone, it becomes very difficult to be able to take a critical stance. Or rather, we think it's going to be difficult to take a critical stance because we are, put it simply, afraid. And it's not as if these are things that I'm saying that you don't recognize. These are all things that you all recognize.
No. We all recognize, and yet we will fully don't discuss or stay shut about it, because we definitely are a part of this survival bubble and we have to survive, you know, make a living for ourselves. So, right.
Exactly. And I've seen that happen, you know, even in a more, like, I have friends, right? And on my blog, I've said like very silly little jokes also, and they stop talking to you for 6 months. I'm like, dude. Look, this is the most silly thing I've ever seen in my life. It's really sometimes childish, but I think architects anyway, they have such thin skins and are anyway so insecure about their own positions that they try and they get offended very easily, I guess. I don't like your work doesn't mean I don't like you. I don't think that's easy for them to understand.
Arguably, yes, when the architect faces criticism, the tendency is to take it personal. It becomes difficult to accept that the criticism or the crit is for the work that you do. That too has its reasons. I mean, extremely extreme involvement in projects. It's my baby syndrome and all that. And this general absence of criticism, I personally feel that we are inadvertently promoting that. You know, we are simply cultivating a bad industry hygiene, right? Okay, a lot of good discussion and a lot of, you know, but well, whatever. So yeah, with that, we will be majorly wrapping it up. It has been a brilliant, brilliant episode to the season. Rohan, all thanks to you for being so eloquent and for addressing the elephant in the room right at the start. And definitely for being so casual while talking about things that makes people crawl back into their own dark space, right? So thanks for that. Now, before closing, we have discussed a good amount of stuff today. For you, anything else that you would like to say for my audience, your closing remarks, anything, your choice?
Nothing. I just think that if we have to be able to kind of really genuinely get the architecture profession to become relevant to our particular context, we really need a space where we can have direct and honest conversations and even confrontations that we are willing to kind of take and not get particularly offended by them, I think. And I think it's an important space to nurture and create such a kind of platform. Maybe the platform itself can be a fairly neutral space that enables these sorts of conversations, choreographs them very carefully such that these kinds of debates at least may not, even if they are not like blatant out and out fights, at least is able to create different positions that can then work with each other. So you can create a space for a sort of dialogue by proxy through the platform, maybe. Maybe that can be the first step as for creating something.
Right. I think that is a very good starting point to have, because we really don't have any platform like that today. And I think I'm taking notes already. So yeah, thumbs up, hands on for that. So yes, a big thanks to you again from me and my audience. A lot of episodes lined up. So folks, keep your eyes and ears open. Head to the description box for Rohan's bio and his social media links. Do follow our media handles as well. The description has all the links for you. And so yeah, that's that. We are closing for today. Till the next time. Cheers.